All right. A few more slides left in this enzyme chapter. We're up to slide 11. I haven't talked about this at all yet, but what we're looking at here is inhibition of an enzyme. I already told you last time that enzymes can be turned on or off, meaning enabled or disabled. Well, inhibition, of course, is a way of disabling an enzyme. At least temporarily, it could be permanently, but usually it's a temporary situation. And the fundamental difference here between A and B is how this inhibition occurs. You have competitive inhibition, you have non-competitive inhibition. Now, competitive inhibition gets its name because there's going to be two different kinds of particles competing, in a sense, for that one active site that's on the enzyme. Because of specificity, any given enzyme has a certain substrate for which it's intended, in a sense, right? The normal substrate is one thing that is able to fit into that active site. And if it's the substrate that fits in there, the enzyme converts that substrate into product. That's how enzymes work. It's possible, though, for a non-substrate particle to be similar enough in shape and chemistry to the substrate for it also to be able to fit in that active site. The difference is that non-substrate particle, by fitting into that active site, does not get converted into anything. And therefore, all it does, if it's there, is block the active site. Well, without the active site available, the enzyme's not going to work as an enzyme. So we call such a particle an inhibitor. It would be specifically a competitive inhibitor if it binds to the active site. Now, that can be a temporary situation. So only while the competitive inhibitor is bound to the active site is that enzyme turned off. If it's able to leave and there's still substrate available, then the substrate is free to get in there and be converted into product. Now, the fundamental difference here between that and non-competitive inhibition is the location where the inhibitor binds. Non-competitive inhibition is non-competitive because the inhibitor is not competing for that one available active site. It's not competing with the substrate for binding to the same place on the enzyme that the substrate would. Instead, there is a different site called an allosteric site where the inhibitor binds. Now, it's pretty clear how a competitive inhibitor blocks the action of the enzyme, right? Just doesn't allow the substrate in there. Why would the binding of a non-competitive inhibitor to some place on the enzyme other than the active site block substrate from being turned into product? Right, because of the general thing that happens when a ligand binds to a protein. This is another example of a ligand binding to a protein. The non-competitive inhibitor is an example of a ligand. The enzyme, of course, is a protein. And so that binding causes a conformational change in the protein. The shape change is such that the active site gets distorted enough so that the substrate, even if present, no longer can bind to that active site and therefore no longer gets turned into product. If that non-competitive inhibitor pops off of that allosteric binding site, though, then the original shape will be resumed, and therefore the active site will once again be available for substrate if substrate is there. In 12, this flowchart looking thing is an example of what we call feedback inhibition, which is a very common way that biochemical pathways are controlled in cells. First of all, what is a biochemical pathway? Well, it is a sequence of reactions, chemical reactions. But what makes a pathway, rather than just a group of unrelated reactions, a pathway is arranged so that the product of the first reaction serves as the reactant for the second reaction. It's going to get turned into some other product, which is then going to be the reactant in the third reaction, and so on. So the output of from each step feeds the next step. And therefore, it's a stepwise transition from some original reactant that enters the pathway into some final product that gets produced at the end. This example doesn't matter, but we're using as an example threonine as the initial substrate, stepwise getting turned into, finally, isoleucine. But you could just as easily study this by saying A gets turned into B, which gets turned into C, and F might be the final product. That can be any number of steps. Well, like I told you last time, effectively, every biochemical reaction occurring in your cells is catalyzed. Therefore, there is a specific enzyme responsible for converting reactant into product at each step. These are different enzymes, which is why they're called enzyme 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 here. The intermediates are just short-lived because they're not the goal. You have to make each intermediate to feed the next step. But the cell is trying to finally make isoleucine because it needs it at the moment. All right? Since it's a pathway, you could stop production of isoleucine by disabling any one of these enzymes, right? Why does it make sense to disable the first one in this pathway, the first enzyme? Yeah, because if you shut down enzyme 5, yes, you would shut down production of isoleucine, but you would still be making all these intermediates that you don't need if you don't need isoleucine. If you go back to the first step and shut it down, that's the most efficient use of your resources, not only materials, but energy. So that's what feedback inhibition typically does. This feedback inhibition is a classic example of negative feedback. There's negative feedback and there's positive feedback, but negative feedback is the only type of feedback that can reduce or negate, which is why it's called negative feedback, negate the error. The error in a feedback system is simply the difference between the set point or the desired amount and what you really have. All right? So in this case, the set point, like I said, the cell, for whatever reason, needs isoleucine at the moment. That's why this biochemical pathway is invoked. As long as the cell continues to need isoleucine, isoleucine will be used up as it's produced. Okay? And therefore, there's no error. The amount of isoleucine is correct. But eventually the cell won't need any more isoleucine. The enzymes don't know that, right? They're just busy producing product out of reactant. So isoleucine will start to build up if the cell is no longer using it. And that buildup is an error. It's an example of an error. The error now is too much isoleucine. So feedback inhibition uses that buildup of product as a signal that this biochemical pathway is no longer needed, and the product itself feeds back to an earlier part in the biochemical pathway and shuts down the whole pathway. And the way it does that is by allosterically binding to usually the first enzyme in the pathway. And by allosterically binding, I mean non-competitively binding. So that first enzyme, as you see in the cartoon, has an allosteric site. That allosteric site, separate by definition, is separate from the active site. So substrate doesn't bind to the allosteric site. The allosteric site is specific for isoleucine. And if there's a bunch of it around, which means there's too much, it becomes much more likely that it's going to bind to that allosteric site on enzyme 1, shutting down that first step, and therefore shutting down the whole pathway. Now, if the cell starts using isoleucine again, it will become rare enough, it'll run out, and it therefore just by diffusion, isoleucine will pop off of this enzyme and activate it again automatically. So that's classic negative feedback, but specifically when we're talking about a biochemical pathway, we call it feedback inhibition. 13. Now, hopefully it will make sense to you that while there is competitive inhibition, there wouldn't be competitive activation. Inhibition is turning off an enzyme. Activation is turning it on, right? That wouldn't make sense to turn on an enzyme by having something block the active site, right? That's only going to turn it off. So you have competitive inhibition. But if you control an enzyme allosterically by that control particle binding somewhere other than the active site, then you can either activate an enzyme or inhibit it by that shape change. So there are what we generally call allosteric effectors with an E, actually two E's. That's the general term, but there are two types of allosteric effectors. There are allosteric inhibitors, there are allosteric activators. And different enzymes have one or the other, some have both. An enzyme that has sites for both activators and inhibitors is exquisitely controllable, right? But some can either be, some are normally off and have to be activated, and therefore won't work unless there is an allosteric activator that comes along and binds to the active site, which will put that active site, binds to the allosteric site, which will put that active site into the right conformation for a substrate. Or there are some enzymes that are normally on, and therefore substrate can bind right away, but they can be turned off by an allosteric inhibitor coming along and binding to the allosteric site. Does that all make sense? Okay. I think 14 is the final slide in this chapter, and we're just looking at a specific example to show you how well cells can control their biochemical pathways. The example used here is glycogenolysis, which is spelled just like glycogenolysis, all one word, right? And by me saying it that way, it should tell you what glycogenolysis is, which is what? The breakdown of glycogen. What is glycogen? Well, it is sugar, but what's more specifically, what is glycogen? More specifically, it's a storage polysaccharide, right? It's the animal version. Well, not just animals, but we animals make storage polysaccharide called glycogen. It's storage polysaccharide because it's there for the purpose of storing glucose, which we want to use as fuel eventually. When it comes time to use the glucose as fuel, we can't burn that glucose metabolically unless it's liberated from the glycogen molecule. So you have an enzyme called glycogen phosphorylase that does just that. One glucose at a time, it will strip off of this big polysaccharide that's made up of a bunch of glucoses. All right. A typical way that an enzyme can be activated or inactivated is by phosphorylation or dephosphorylation. And it depends on the particular enzyme whether phosphorylation turns it on or off. It could be either. Depends on the enzyme. But whatever phosphorylation does to the enzyme, activate it or deactivate it, dephosphorylation does the opposite. So phosphate groups being attached to or detached from an enzyme is a way to switch it on and off, typical way. And glycogen phosphorylase is an example of that. So notice that in its phosphorylated state, down on the bottom here, the phosphorylated state, when it has phosphates attached to it, glycogen phosphorylase is active. Which is why up here with the phosphates, it's doing its job of cleaving off that terminal glucose, which is now on its own to be used as a fuel. Well, you don't always want this to happen, right? You don't want to be breaking down glycogen when it's inappropriate to do so. So glycogen phosphorylase, which is an enzyme, is itself controlled by the action of two other enzymes. Phosphorylase kinase is an enzyme that is an example of a kinase. Kinases, there's all kinds of kinases, but kinases are enzymes that specifically phosphorylate proteins. Sometimes, and often, those proteins that they phosphorylate are other enzymes. But that's what a kinase does in general. It phosphorylates something. So phosphorylase kinase is the enzyme responsible for phosphorylating glycogen phosphorylase to make it active so that it can break down glycogen. You have a third enzyme that's responsible for switching off glycogen phosphorylase, and that's phosphorylase phosphatase. There's all kinds of phosphatases in your body as well. That's a category of enzymes. It's the opposite, functionally speaking, to a kinase. So kinases phosphorylate things. Phosphatases dephosphorylate things. And this is just a specific example of a kinase and a phosphatase. They're called phosphorylase kinase and phosphorylase phosphatase because the specific thing that they phosphorylate or dephosphorylate is itself a phosphorylase, glycogen phosphorylase. All right? So three enzymes involved just to control this one step. And that this is why you, of your roughly 20,000 protein-coding genes, most of those code for enzymes. Enzymes are all over the place. There's all kinds of enzymes because you have to have that specificity in order for certain things to work and other things not to work appropriately. All right, that's the chapter.